Hi, welcome to Local Matters. I'm Margaret Williams, the news editor for Mountain Express, and I'm joined today by senior news reporter David Forbes, who's going to tell us a little bit about the Asheville 11.
Yes, as they've been popularly dubbed, not least by a number of anarchist activists here and, well, around the country, really. Back in May 1st, to be exact, it's a traditional day for leftist political protests. And there were a number, including an immigration reform rally in downtown. There was an anti-capitalist party in Aston Park. However, that night, a group of people went around downtown and vandalized a number of businesses. Some of them were corporate chains, and some of them were local businesses, and even some of them very small local businesses, as well as some cars. The police arrested 11 people and charged them with everything from some misdemeanor vandalism charges up to felony rioting charges. And in the process, this has kind of become a cause célèbre for some anarchists around the country who assert that these the 11 are being, who most of them are not from Asheville, and some of whom are being targeted and were rounded up indiscriminately. We have a post up at Mountain Express now as kind of a primer looking at the reactions from across the spectrum, including from some anarchists who are not supportive of what's become known as the 11 and kind of calling for maybe a little bit more nuance and a little bit more thought being directed towards this subject, since people mostly just kind of love to yell about it so far.
And they got a court date.
They do. Yes, this Monday they were in court and a trial date was set for January 24th. However, the district attorney's office has not yet decided to try some of them individually, all 11 together. And one thing I kind of, a point I make in the primer, is that people need to remember these are 11 individuals, and we simply don't know yet whether all will be guilty, all will be acquitted, or some will be found guilty and some will be acquitted. It's certainly a much more complicated case, I think, than a number of people have made it out to be.
There was also recently a rally, a march on behalf of the Asheville 11?
Yes, a march that was termed the police as the absolute enemy, among other things, and was expressed through a number of marchers, 30 to 40 people, marched from downtown towards the Buncombe County Jail and back to Pritchard Park. They would identify themselves to the media and generally had anti-APD, anti-state, pro-anarchist slogans, and then despite the term the police as the absolute enemy, they didn't really clash them much except for blocking off.
It was pretty peaceful.
Yeah, it blocked off the right lane of College Street one time before the police asked them to get back on the sidewalk, and they did. So
good. Yeah. Well, folks, take a look at that. David has an analysis of the Asheville 11, kind of giving a little background, a little history like we just discussed. So take a look at that and see what you think. Before we let David Forbes slip out of here for his Friday, tell us a little bit about what City Council will be talking about next week.
Well, City Council meets next Tuesday at 5 p.m., and it's their last meeting of the year, and they will be considering the major issue is the 51 Biltmore Project, which is a mixed-use development, parking garage, a number of other things tied to there. This has attracted some controversy because one of the city council members, Cecil Bothwell, has been a very vocal critic of this project, says it's in his words, a money pit. It's not necessary that Asheville should look at alternative methods of transportation besides just building more parking decks. At the same time, you have people like Pat Whalen, who's the head of Public Interest Projects, a local and well-known development firm around here, who says that to make the city sustainable and denser, you need projects like this, and this is the best use for the area. We haven't seen where the other council members are going to weigh in yet. Last time, when a financing issue was up for a vote for this project, Bothwell was one of the only dissenters, and it passed without too much trouble. But it's been enough of a public issue now. It may attract some other comments or maybe modify it in some ways.
Council members hosting a public hearing about that property, about the... Well, they're going, zoning, the disposition?
They're going to be discussing it, yes.
Okay. And that's on December 14th on Tuesday. Thank you, David, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And now we're joined by John Elliston, Asheville-based writer and former managing editor of Express. He's got a story about what's been happening in the past over at Rosman at the old research center there. Can you tell us a little bit more about it, John?
Sure. The Rosman Research Station is one of the enduring mysteries of recent Western North Carolina history in that from 1981 to 1995, it was home to a top secret facility run by the National Security Agency.
By the NSA? And what did they do there?
Well, the NSA is one of the most secretive agencies in the intelligence community, and they're tasked with making and breaking codes and with conducting encrypted communications around the globe and also intercepting enemy communications. And so they are master eavesdroppers, and from their station near Rossman in the Pisgah National Forest, it's been believed that they mostly focused on Soviet military satellite communications and communications coming out of Cuba at the time, where the Soviets had their own signals intelligence facility.
You took a recent trip down there to check out the facilities and look around, but I imagine you've been there a few times before.
Indeed, and we should stress that nowadays the facility is the Pisgah Astronomical Research Institute, which is a nonprofit that is very open. It doesn't do any clandestine work whatsoever. It's this thriving center for science education and research. And each week they give free tours to anyone who'd like to schedule one, and they will take you into the bowels of what was once a secret facility, and you can go places where during the 80s and early 90s were strictly off limits to anyone without a security clearance.
Yeah, there's a good cover story on that in this month's Bold Life. It tells you a little bit more about Perry, and we feature that pretty regularly on our website and in the news when there's a meteor shower coming up, for example. But, John, you were able to uncover some documents. I know this is one of your little... You like to look into this kind of secret stuff, and you got hold of some declassified documents.
Of course, while the NSA was in Rossman, and even in the time since, it's been very close-lipped about what it did there, owing to the secrecy of its operations. But now, for the first time, the agency has declassified a small stack of documents about its tenure in Rossman, and they were published by a website called governmentattic.com. I recommend it to anyone. It's it's kind of a WikiLeaks for declassified documents. And there has appeared for the first time these NSA documents, giving some sense of what the NSA did at Rossman, and in particular how tricky it was for the agency to pull out once it had conducted its mission there.
But it still left this kind of aura of mystery about it.
Absolutely. It's when you run a secret government facility for 15 years, it's going to lead to all sorts of speculation and rumoring. And indeed, it's been that way in Western North Carolina around this facility at Rossman. So people have had all kinds of fantastic theories about what used to go on there. And that continues to skew some people's perceptions of what goes on there now. It's not rare for visitors to ask if they're allowed to take photos, for example, or if they're allowed to see parts of the facility, when in fact it's quite open and you can photograph anything you like.
They still use those great big satellite dishes?
They sure do. They have two enormous 85-foot diameter radio telescopes we'd recognize as like a giant dish, in addition to several other similar but smaller telescopes and other high-tech facilities for observing the stars and all manner of astronomical phenomena.
You've got a picture of this round thing called a radome. What do they use those for?
A radome. Yeah, it looks to us a lot like a geodesic dome or a big golf ball. And it's essentially a nylon cover that would have inside it some sort of sensitive listening gear. And to protect that gear from the elements and also from the prying eyes of Soviet satellites, they would use things like these radomes to shield sensitive equipment.
Ah, interesting. So folks, stay tuned for that story. You'll see it in the Wednesday edition, December 15th of Mountain Express. Thanks, John, for keeping us up on what's going on.
Thank you, Margaret.
I'm joined by Mountain Express intern and Asheville High student Amanda Varner. She's been working on a special project for our December 22nd issue. Can you tell us something about that?
Well, every year we do a calendar roundup of all local Asheville calendars focusing on nonprofits. And so I've just been working on that this year. We have some different photographers and, of course, the Freaks of Asheville and a couple weather calendars. So they're all really unique, and it's been really cool.
And one that I've seen is they built Asheville. Yes,
yeah,
the first calendar that we got submitted from the, who turned this one into us?
The West North Carolina Historical Association. It has a little story. It's 12 buildings, and each building has a story, and they're really interesting. It's stuff,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I lived here all my life, and I never knew.
With the Jackson Building, you lived here all your long
mm-hmm.
life. The Jackson Building, what are a few others here?
The
St. Lawrence.
The Flatiron,
uh-huh.
The original library. Yeah, it's really interesting, really neat.
Mm-hmm. Any other calendars that you're going to take a look at and tell us about?
The Westville Pub, of course, the kind of...
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a couple more just from Greenworks and different nonprofits
mm-hmm.
around Asheville that
mm-hmm.
we're going to be getting in soon.
And unfortunately, the Soda Fountain Girls aren't doing
this. They
decided
not to do it. They said probably next year, but not this year.
Okay, we're going to have to hold them to that.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Amanda.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I'm joined by Jake Frankel, our reporter, who's been covering the commission meetings and also recently did a little story on the farm conservation. I went to a forum that was held recently and have some thoughts to share with us about what you learned.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I spoke with a wide range of people involved in the farming industry in the area and also the efforts to preserve farmland, everyone from people that work at the soil and water districts in the area to environmentalists who are working with conservation easements to preserve land. They pointed to a lot of figures that show Western North Carolina is losing its farmland at a really rapid pace. Blue Ridge Forever is one of the organizations that put together a recent forum discussing these issues. And they found that 125,000 acres were lost in Western North Carolina between 2002 and 2007. And
okay.
Of all the counties in the region...
Buncombe's leading the way.
Buncombe, unfortunately, is leading the way in that category with 22,847 acres lost, which was interesting because a lot of people actually pointed to the county commissioner's efforts as being an example of good things that are being done. But just because this county is growing so fast and is
mm-hmm.
so appealing to so many people, they still have lost a lot of land.
Something interesting I recall from reading the story was that there's a perception that creating a subdivision or a new development increases the tax base, tax dollars for the county, when actually at the forum some folks said that that wasn't necessarily the case.
Yeah, that was very interesting. What they found when they studied this issue is that oftentimes developments cost more in tax money than they actually generate when you take into account all the services that it takes, such as
mm-hmm.
sewage and new roads. And they found that preserving farmland actually generates more tax income to local governments. And they're waging a campaign to get the word out about that. They also put a big emphasis on the private kind of economic impact in terms of jobs that farms have in the area. Studies show that Western North Carolina has about 13,000 working farms that generated $900 million in 2007, the last year they have a study for it. And that also they generate about 33,000 jobs. So in a time like now when people are really concerned about jobs in the area, preserving farmland seems to be a way to actually create jobs, which that point can be lost sometimes when developers argue they want to put in housing developments.
Mm-hmm. A different kind of development that commissioners were looking at this past week was the Ingalls. Ingalls Markets has a planned expansion, and that's connected to the whole jobs creation and tax-based stuff, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Ingalls qualified for almost $100 million in federal stimulus loans because they want to put a new big distribution and warehouse facility at their headquarters in Black Mountain and also put a new store in on Smoky Mountain Highway that they project will, both of those together, will create around 190 full-time jobs plus a lot of jobs for the construction.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you can catch all of that news in the December 15th issue that's coming out soon. Thanks, Jake.
Thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.